I want to try a little experiment to kick things off today. I want you to look around wherever you are right now and just find something red.
Right, like a coffee mug on your desk or a stop sign if you're driving.
Yeah, exactly. Or, if you're feeling a bit poetic, maybe a rose in a garden. You see that color, right? It feels totally undeniable. It's vibrant, it's there, it's real. But I'm going to start today's deep dive with a claim that probably sounds absolutely delusional. That rose, it isn't actually red.
And just to make matters worse, it doesn't actually smell like a rose either, and the softness of the petals, that isn't really there in the object itself.
This is exactly where we are living today. We are unpacking a stack of research centered on the philosophy of John Locke, specifically his theory of ideas and what's called the representational theory of knowledge. And honestly, the mission here is a bit uncomfortable
Oh, very uncomfortable.
because it challenges the most basic assumption we all have, which is that we are seeing the world exactly as it is.
It really pulls the rug out from under you. Locke is essentially arguing that the rose, as you experience it, is basically a colorless, odorless collection of particles.
Right.
The redness, the scent, the texture, all of that is a movie playing inside your head. It's a production of your mind, not a property of the actual object.
Which begs the massive question, right? If the red isn't on the rose, where is it? And if we aren't seeing the world directly, what on earth are we seeing?
And that is the question that defined modern philosophy. We're looking at source material from Dr. Arthur Holmes and Locke's own essay concerning human understanding. We're going to find out if we ever actually touch reality or if we're just trapped in a private screening room for our entire lives.
Let's get into that screening room concept because I think it's foundational. Locke calls this the representational theory of knowledge, and it sounds technical, but the mechanism is actually quite intuitive once you wrap your head around it.
It really is. Think of it this way. Locke, much like Descartes, argues that your mind never touches the world directly. When you look at a tree, your mind isn't connecting with the bark or the leaves. Your mind is connecting with an idea of a tree.
So the idea is kind of the middleman.
The idea is the only man you ever meet. Locke says ideas are the immediate objects of our awareness. Your senses capture data, they transmit it to the mind, and the mind projects an image. You are watching the projection, not the source.
Okay, but I assume the projection matches the source, right? Like, I see a tree because there is a physical tree.
Well, you infer that there is a tree, and that is the critical distinction here. You are observing your own mental ideas and inferring that there is an external world causing them.
I can see why you called this dangerous earlier, because if I'm only ever looking at the representation, like the picture on the screen, I can never actually turn around and check the projector.
You've hit the nail on the head. If I show you a photograph of a person you've never met, you know the photo exists, but you have no way of proving the person is real.
They could be AI generated or something.
Exactly. They could be a painting. You are stuck with a representation.
And Locke realizes this.
He absolutely does. Dr. Holmes points out that this theory opens the door to a profound skepticism. If we only know the phenomena, which are the appearances, how do we prove the existence of material bodies?
Right.
How do I prove you are a conscious mind and not just a robot my mind invented? How do we prove moral obligations or even God?
It feels incredibly isolating, like we're all locked in solitary confinement, just watching shadows on the wall.
It is isolating. But Locke isn't trying to depress us. He's actually trying to build a system of knowledge from the ground up. He wants to know what the bricks are. If our reality is built of ideas, what are the ideas made of?
And he calls these the atoms of thought, or simple ideas.
Right, simple ideas, these are indivisible, you can't break them down. Blueness, coldness, a single tone of sound.
Okay.
And Locke is an empiricist, which means he believes there are only two delivery trucks that bring these materials into the warehouse of the mind.
Sensation and reflection.
Correct. Sensation is the outer sense, the five physical inputs: sight, sound, touch, taste, smell.
And then reflection is the inner sense.
Yes, it's the mind looking in the mirror. You don't get the idea of thinking or doubting from your eyes. You get it by catching yourself in the act of doubting. You observe the machinery of your own mind working.
There is a really fascinating hypothesis in the notes about this involving a statue. I think it was attributed to the French philosopher Condillac.
Yes, the Baron de Condillac. He takes Locke's logic to the extreme. He asks us to imagine a statue, or just a man encased in stone, who's never had a single sensory input.
So no sight, no touch, no sound.
Totally sealed off. The question is, would that statue have consciousness?
My gut instinct says maybe. I mean, I can close my eyes and sit in a dark room, and I'm still me.
But you have a lifetime of memories to replay. You have language.
Yeah.
This statue has absolutely nothing. The conclusion for the source material is that, likely, there is no self there.
Because there's nothing to reflect on.
Precisely. Locke argues that sensory interaction is what awakens the mind. You need the outer sense to give the inner sense something to do. If you've never seen red, never felt cold, never heard a sound, your mind is a blank slate.
There's no data to process.
Right. So there's no awareness of processing.
That is genuinely terrifying. It implies that we are purely a reaction to the world around us. Without the world, we just vanish.
It connects back to that blank slate or tabula rasa concept Locke is so famous for. We aren't born with thoughts. We are born with the capacity for thoughts, which only activate when the world hits us.
So we need the world to wake us up.
Mm.
But, and here is where we loop back to that red rose. The world that wakes us up is tricking us. This brings us to the distinction between primary and secondary qualities. And I have to say, this was the part of the reading where I actually put the notes down and stared at the wall for a minute.
It's a total Matrix moment.
Yeah.
Locke says, look, some things are objectively in the object. He calls those primary qualities.
These are the physics thing.
Newtonian physics.
Mm.
Spatial occupancy, shape, size, density, motion. If a ball is round, it is round whether you are looking at it or not. Its mass is real. Its movement is real. These are the properties that science actually measures.
But then we have the secondary quality.
Other. Sound, smell, taste, temperature.
And Locke says these exist where exactly?
Only in you. They are completely subjective.
So let's apply this to the rose.
Okay, the rose has a primary quality. It has a specific texture or arrangement of particles on its surface. That texture is real,
right.
But that texture isn't red. It just has the power to manipulate light in a way that, when it hits your eye, produces the sensation of redness in your mind.
So the rose isn't red, it just has a red-making texture.
Exactly. And the rose isn't sweet-smelling. It has a chemical structure that triggers a sweet reaction in your nose. If you vanish, the redness and the sweetness vanish with you. All that's left is a silent, colorless, odorless mass of particles.
It just sucks the life out of the world, doesn't it? The notes mention that the Romantic poets absolutely hated this idea.
Oh, they despise it. It offended them on a deep level. You have Tennyson asking, can I take a thing so dead? They felt that science was killing the glory of nature.
Like Wordsworth talking about his heart dancing with the daffodils. He thought the yellow was the dance.
Right. He thought the vibrancy was out there, alive in the field. Locke comes along and says, sorry, William, the daffodils are just matter in motion. The dance and the yellow are just a hallucination happening in your brain.
It's a cold, silent universe. But we don't experience it as a cold, silent universe. We experience apples and humans and gold. How do we get from these raw, colorless atoms to the complex objects we deal with every day?
This is the second stage of Locke's factory. We move from simple ideas to complex ideas.
The mind playing Lego.
Essentially, yes. The mind is active here. It takes a simple idea of round, red, crisp, and sweet, and it bundles them together to create the mental construct of an apple.
But here is the puzzle Dr. Holmes highlighted in the source. If I have a bundle of qualities, redness, roundness, sweetness, what is actually holding them together, qualities can't just float in the air. We assume there is a thing that is red.
Ah, the problem of substance. This is where Locke gets refreshingly honest. He admits that we assume there must be a support for these qualities. But since we only ever perceive the qualities, we only see the red, we only feel the round here. We never actually perceive the thing underneath.
So how does he define substance then?
He literally calls it something I know not what.
Something I know not what. I mean, that sounds like a cop-out.
It sounds like it, but it's actually rigorous philosophical humility. He's saying, I know there's a pincushion holding all these pins, but I'm blind to the pincushion. I only feel the pins.
This pattern seems to be Locke's signature. We see the effect, but we just assume the cause. The source material spent a lot of time on the idea of power or cause and effect.
This is crucial because it sets the stage for David Hume later on. Locke points out that we don't actually see power.
What do you mean? Like if I push a glass and it falls, I caused it.
You saw your hand move, then you saw the glass move.
Mm-hmm.
You saw event A, then event B. But did you see the connection? Did you see the actual force transfer?
No, I just saw the sequence.
Exactly. We observe the conjunction, the fact that they happen together. The power or the cause is a complex idea we construct to explain the sequence. We don't experience it directly.
We really are writing the script for reality as we go. We add in the because.
And we do the exact same thing with the biggest concept of all, God.
Now, we should clarify, Locke was religious. He wasn't trying to disprove God.
No, his father was a strict Puritan, a signatory to the Westminster Confession. Locke insists we have no innate idea of God. We aren't born with a knowledge of a creator stamped on our souls like a trademark.
So how do we build the idea of God if we can't see him?
We build him out of spare parts we find in ourselves.
Spare parts.
We look at our own reflection. We find qualities like wisdom, power, goodness, love. We know what those feel like.
Yeah.
Then we use the idea of infinity. We just keep adding and adding.
So we take human wisdom and multiply by infinity.
And you get omniscience. You take human power, multiply by infinity, and you get omnipotence. The idea of God is a human projection blown up to an infinite scale.
That is almost blasphemous coming from a Puritan background. It suggests we created God in our image rather than the other way around.
At least regarding the idea of God, yes. The sources are careful to note that Locke isn't saying God is a construct, but he is saying our understanding of God is limited to these magnified human concepts. We simply can't think outside our own box.
Let's shift gears to one more way we construct our world. Universals. We talk about humans or dogs or triangles. But in nature, you only ever see this specific guy or that specific poodle.
This is the classic problem of universals. Locke is a conceptualist. He believes we create these general categories through a process called abstraction.
Which is basically editing, right?
It's selective ignoring. To get the idea of a triangle, you have to ignore whether it's obtuse, acute, or right-angled. You ignore the size, you ignore the color of the ink. You strip away everything specific until you're left with just the bare definition.
The source described the abstract idea of an animal as a body with life, sense, and spontaneous motion.
Right. No fur, no scales, no barking, no meowing, just the core essence. And Locke argues that this power of abstraction is what separates humans from animals.
Animals can't do this.
Locke says no. A dog knows its master, but it doesn't have a general abstract concept of master. Animals deal in particulars. Humans build these general boxes, these words to sort the world into. Language is just the labeling system for our abstract boxes.
So to recap all of this, we are trapped in a movie theater of our own mind. We watch simple ideas that may or may not look like the real world. We bundle them into objects, assume a substance holds them, assume causes connect them, and build abstract categories to organize them.
That is the Lockean condition. We are the architects of our own reality.
The billion-dollar question, then, is how much of this can we actually trust? If I'm just making all this up, do I know anything?
This brings us to Locke's hierarchy of knowledge. And I have to warn you, if you love science, this is going to hurt a little bit.
Lay it on me.
Locke identifies three levels of knowledge. Level one is intuitive knowledge. This is things that are immediately obvious. I exist. A equals A. I am in pain.
Okay. High certainty.
Absolute certainty. You don't need proof. You just know. Level two is demonstrative knowledge. This is logical proof, like mathematics. If a triangle has 180 degrees, it must have 180 degrees. It's a logical necessity. If you follow the steps, the conclusion is airtight.
Still feeling pretty good. What is level three?
Sensitive knowledge. This is our knowledge of the outside world. The rose.
Yeah.
The tree. The chair you're sitting in.
Yeah.
Locke says this is not certain. It does not qualify as strict knowledge. It is only probability. It falls under the category of opinion or belief.
Wait, so my knowledge that 2 + 2 = 4 is higher than my knowledge that my car is parked outside?
Significantly higher. You can prove 2 + 2 = 4. You cannot logically prove your car is outside. You can only say, I saw it 5 minutes ago. And usually cars don't vanish, so it is probable that it is there. But you could be hallucinating. Someone could have stolen it. The world could have ended. You don't know.
That makes science feel like, well, like gambling.
It is gambling. It's highly sophisticated gambling. Locke says we can never reach 100% certainty about the physical world. We just pile up enough evidence to make a really, really good bet.
And this is where he gives us that famous maxim, proportion your assent to the evidence.
Right. Don't believe anything 100% if the evidence is only 90%. Be a rational calculator. If you have a little evidence, have a little belief. If you have a lot of evidence, have a lot of belief. Never be absolutely certain about the outside world.
That sounds incredibly sensible. It sounds like the basis of the scientific method. But the source material ended with a massive critique of this. It mentioned reformed epistemology and philosophers like Nicholas Wolterstorff and Alvin Plantinga. They basically tell Locke he's out of his mind.
They attack the very foundation of Locke's advice. They ask a very simple question. Is belief actually voluntary?
Locke assumes it is. He thinks I can look at the evidence for the car being outside and decide I will grant this 85% belief.
Exactly. He treats belief like a faucet you can turn up or down. But the critics say, when did you decide to believe the floor was solid?
I didn't. I just believe it.
Right. You don't calculate the probability of the floor holding you up every time you take a step. You have what the Scottish realists call a belief-forming mechanism. It's a reflex.
So we are just wired to believe.
Yes. We spontaneously believe in material bodies. We spontaneously believe that other people have minds. It's not a rational calculation. It's a function of being human.
There's a great quote in the notes about this. It said, "If someone doubts the external world, they don't need a philosopher. They need a therapist."
That's the evidence trap. If you wait for sufficient evidence to prove the world is real, you'll be paralyzed. Locke wants us to be these cold, rational scientists. But the critique is that we are actually biological machines designed to trust our senses, regardless of the evidence.
That is such a fascinating clash. You have Locke saying, doubt everything until you have proof, and the critic saying, you can't help but believe, so stop pretending.
And that tension defines the world we live in now. We use Locke's scientific method to build technology, to create vaccines, to fly planes, all based on probability. But we live our daily lives with that reformed confidence that the world is real and our friends love us, even if we can't prove it mathematically.
We are split right down the middle. Rational skeptics in the lab, believers at the dinner table.
It's the only way to function. If you lived like a true Lockean 24 hours a day, you'd never get out of bed because you couldn't prove the floor was there.
So we've journeyed from a rose that isn't red through a mind that projects its own reality all the way to the realization that our knowledge of the world is just a probable opinion.
It's a humbling perspective. Locke puts the human mind at the center of the universe. We create the colors, the sounds, the categories, but he also locks us inside that mind. We can never step outside the theater.
And that leads to a final thought I want to leave with you. If Locke is right, if we never truly touch reality, but only interact with our own mental ideas, are we all just isolated minds interpreting our own private screenings of the universe?
And if the critics are right that belief isn't voluntary, are you actually in control of what you consider true? Or is your mind just programmed to accept the movie as real, no matter how strange the plot gets?
Something to chew on the next time you admire a red rose. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us.
Always a pleasure.